now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer. The 2019-2020 Premier League season is underway. We're going to be with you twice a week for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business. Joining Gregor Robertson and I in the studio today, it is Molly Hudson. Plus, we have Chief Football Correspondent for The Times, Oliver Kay, on the show as well. Later on, we'll take a look at how the Premier League new boys looked as they got their campaigns underway. And of course, VAR was always going to steal the show as it made its domestic debut in the top flight of English football. Liverpool and Manchester City picked up where they left off, but it was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Manchester United that put in the performance of the weekend as they swept past Frank Lampard's Chelsea 4-0. So Manchester United recorded their biggest Old Trafford win over Chelsea since 1965 to condemn Lampard to a miserable start as a Premier League manager. The Chelsea boss called it a reality check himself. It probably is a wake-up call for Frank Lampard, isn't it, Ollie?
I don't know about wake-up call. I mean, it was. I don't know, it probably started as if it was going like a dream and then turned into a very strange, bad, surreal dream in that a good performance just unravelled dramatically in the sort of from 65 minutes onwards. They still were very much in the game at 1-0 down. I mean, they didn't deserve to be 1-0 down when they went behind. They kept creating chances in the first half. I'd say they were probably playing in just the way he wanted, apart from a couple of sort of aberrations from Kurt Zouma. But after they went 2-0 down, they just collapsed terribly, and United, with a speed that they have on the counter with Rashford and Martial and Pogba, once he got the bit between his teeth, it just became a completely different game, completely different to everything that happened before. So I think Lampard probably got it right when he said that there were a lot of things he liked in the performance and four or five things that he really didn't like, because it was a curious performance in many ways.
Yeah, Molly, perhaps 4-0 wasn't a fair scoreline on reflection of what we saw at Old Trafford.
Yeah, I think Frank said after the game that it was literally four mistakes for each of the goal. And what was so good about United was how clinical they were, because they had those chances and they took them, and that sort of, it was literally a blink and you'll miss it. They were, you know, it was 1-0, it was a bit nervy, and as Ollie said, Chelsea were creating some really good chances, probably playing the better football, in fact. And then as quick as that, it was over, and the scoreline was a bit embarrassing, I guess, for Frank. But it was one of those things where, as we were saying earlier, how much do you actually take from that first game? Because, you know, there's a couple of players that was out injured, you know, new signings are settling in. And I think, you know, I guess what will be really interesting is how Chelsea react against Liverpool in midweek and how they do going forward. And whether, I guess, United can be that clinical, because if they can, with Harry Maguire as a new signing and Lindelof looking like a promising centre-back partnership, if they can combine that with being so clinical going forward, I think, you know, they could surprise a few people.
We'll talk more about Manchester United in just a moment, but Gregor, let's get your take on what we saw with Chelsea. Obviously, we spoke in our preview podcast about the transfer embargo that they're under right now. So we always knew it was going to be a difficult start to Frank Lampard's campaign.
Yeah, I think there's a danger of us reading too much into it. I think we all agree it was not quite, it certainly wasn't a 4-0 game. Mm. Chelsea could have scored in the first half quite easily, hit the woodwork twice. And Manchester United were clinical, as Molly said. So it wasn't a 4-0 game. I think Frank Lampard's hand was forced slightly. Kante, Willian, Rudiger, three experienced players that are likely to return in the coming weeks. And it's always going to be this way. This is supposed to be a kind of a brave new era for Chelsea. I know it's enforced, but there are a lot of players out there with very little Premier League experience compared to the Chelsea teams we know, and they're going to have to learn pretty quickly, I think.
Well, the Manchester United fans were, as you would expect, very quick to get on the back of Frank Lampard with their chanting in the stadium. How patient do you think the Chelsea fans and board can be, Ollie?
The fans will be patient, and they will make allowances for Lampard that they didn't really make for Maurizio Sarri or certain other managers that they've had over the years. I mean, they were chanting Lampard's name throughout yesterday. I don't think Sarri's name was ever chanted at all, apart from in fairly derogatory terms. As for the board, I mean, who knows? It's just such an enigma with Abramovich. Sort of nobody can quite work out just how hands off he is at the moment. But the interesting thing is, and I tweeted something post match yesterday. It was fairly kind of I thought balanced about you know, saying, well, this is why he didn't pick. This is why he picked the younger players, not rather the older players. And people are sort of saying, oh, you would have hammered Sarri for that. Personally speaking, the only thing I ever even criticised Sarri for, and I think the only thing he really got wrong at Chelsea, was not really giving the young players enough chance and often going with experienced players like Giroud, Zappacosta at times, like Alonso, who didn't really suit his style, at the expense of the younger players. So I think the thing that Lampard did yesterday in picking the younger players was the right thing to do. I don't think there's much future in going with Giroud and Alonso and Zappacosta and people like that who don't suit the style that Chelsea want to play. But there will be there will inevitably be some pain along the way, and I think the fans get that. I think the fans are on board with it.
Chelsea's most experienced player yesterday as well, Aspilicueta, was someone who was at fault for two of the goals too. So it's not really fair to sort of lump everything onto the young players. And I know that it's a big change for Chelsea, and to have Mason Mount and Zuma and Tammy Abraham in the starting lineup is exciting, and it's not worked out well in the first weekend. But it's early days, and I don't think we should read too much into that result.
Well, there are obviously plenty of positives for Frank Lampard to take away from that game. In particular, I thought Mason Mount did really well on his Premier League debut, Molly.
Definitely, I think so. And I think he's probably a player more than anyone that's actually shown what Frank Lampard can do as a manager. I think when he went to Derby, he was still very much developing, and he really improved over the course of last season. And I think he more than deserved that chance to play yesterday. And I think, I know Jose Mourinho sort of said maybe, you know, he picked out a couple of the younger players and Mount was one of them that maybe they should have expected a little bit more from. But I think Mount actually played pretty well. And I think, you know, he's showed that he probably is ready for the Premier League now. And he's one of those that's actually shown how important that development and that loan spell in the Championship actually proved, because he had the chance to play week in and week out, work out what worked and what didn't in his game. And I think, you know, he'll only grow in confidence. And, you know, as the guys were saying, he's got a manager that believes in him, believes in youth, and I think that'll only benefit Chelsea in the future.
In the post-match press conference at Old Trafford, one of the first questions was about Mount, and was about telling Lampard that Mourinho had sort of singled Mount out and sort of questioned his performance, and Lampard seemed quite shocked and appalled by that. He was saying, oh, what? He actually said that about Mason Mount. And I think clearly Mount is not the finished article. Mourinho always wanted players who were the finished article. He wanted battle-hardened players, and Conte and Sarri both wanted that in different ways, different styles. And I think Chelsea, under the transfer embargo, have had to go in a different direction, whether anybody likes it or not. So I don't really think... I think people need to see it in that context, rather than thinking that he was going there to try to scrape a 0-0 with a battle-hardened team, the team that probably Mourinho would have played in the same circumstances, and a team which, as you know, without young players, has had some really bad defeats over the last couple of seasons. Some really bad ones under Sarri, some really bad ones under Conte. So I do think it's time for a rebuild, but you don't go for a long-term rebuild without having some pain.
Well, Gregor, you were saying, you know, we shouldn't read too much into this defeat for Chelsea, but what about the victory for Manchester United?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually on the flip side, we probably shouldn't read too much into that either, because they were clinical in their finish, and it was exciting to see them sort of return to that that fast counter attacking play of sort of Manchester United of old. And there was a lot of positives to take, particularly having Harry Maguire in that back line. He sort of added a bit of presence. I think that's kind of almost what Jose Mourinho was possibly alluding to as well, is that having all these sort of inexperienced players, these young guys in Chelsea's team, sort of that there's not really anyone with a presence. And I think that was something you noticed in Manchester United's back line. Harry Maguire just sort of exudes calm. And people look to him and think, we've got a solid performer beside us now. And just the fact that he's there, his presence, whether he's playing fantastically well or not, I think that sort of, you know, lifts the players around them. And I think that was the difference between the teams. But there was a lot of positives for Manchester United. Paul Pogba, after a sort of pretty tumultuous summer, played really well. And Marcus Rashford suggesting that he's going to be able to step up. It's just if you can do that on a consistent basis throughout the season. So there's a lot of positives for Manchester United. But again, I think we shouldn't read too much into either the sort of result from either perspective.
Well, VAR made its first appearance in the top flight of English football this weekend. Love it or hate it, it is here to stay. And whether you like it or not, it's going to provide plenty of talking points. Oh, goodness, where do we start? Ollie, VAR then, in the Premier League for the first time. What did you make of it this weekend?
I'm not its biggest fan. That's not to say I'm a complete Luddite and don't see the positives in it. I mean, there've been no grave injustices done, I don't think, over the weekend. No scorelines which should have been different. No scoreline results have. Well, that unfortunately, that is not a VAR issue. It's a stupid new rule which, whereby anything that hits the hand in the penalty area for the attacking team, it's a handball. Which, I mean, I think these things are all the result of VAR, because they've had to try to take the subjectivity out of this decision. They've had to try to make it more of a binary thing: black, white. Is it handball? Is it off? You know, no kind of grey areas anymore. And I think the rules in terms of that, the handball, I think they've got all over the place. I mean, the Women's World Cup in the summer, there were so many sort of handballs given that should never have been penalties, in my opinion. And likewise, you know, the Champions League final, for example. The men's Champions League final, that is. I'm not completely on board with this at all. It's one thing that really annoyed me in the West Ham Man City game was that really long delay while they went through it in fine detail to work out that maybe, according to this, you know, the technology that they had, Sterling was about 3 millimetres offside in the lead up to that goal. That is not what, you know, offside. The offside rule was all about stopping people kind of goal hanging and, you know, seeking to gain advantage by being in, you know, way ahead of the defence. It wasn't about this infinitesimal sort of tiny distances, gaps where you're a few millimetres ahead and suddenly you can only spot on the 10th replay after 2 minutes of going through replay. I'm not keen on that at all. I don't think taking 2 minutes to work that out is something that really improves the game. I know people say, I mean, I've had 1,000 or something replies on Twitter where people have said, offside, you know, don't you want the right decisions? I don't want people scrutinising things for 2 or 3 minutes to tell me that, oh yeah, this is offside because it's a hair's breadth ahead of the defender. It's, I don't know. I don't think that is worth the upheaval, but there are improvements in other ways. There were some good decisions that we probably wouldn't have got, but I don't think that particular one, which was the most marginal of all, was a was something really to celebrate, even though it was the correct decision, which I know sounds ludicrous, but it's just, it's the time that it takes.
Well, Molly, we all know what VAR was like at the World Cup for the women's game in France. So we knew what to expect this time around, didn't we? That it was going to cause some controversy?
Well, yeah, to be quite honest, I sort of spent a month in France and then never really wanted to see it ever again. there was just such... Well, I think what is really frustrating for us as writers is you spend so much time talking about VAR when what you want to talk about is the football. And it's suddenly become such a big thing. It's become a bigger thing than if a referee had got a decision wrong and we talked about the fact that it was wrong. Mm. The VAR getting it right is bigger than that just because of the drama and everything that surrounds it. And I think actually Matthew Syed wrote a really good column this morning about it. And he said, you know, the thing with the offside and the marginal offside is, yes, it's offside and it's not, but it takes so long. When you look at, like, the goal line system, even if it's 1 millimetre, it recognises it straight away and it's either it's a goal or it's not a goal. And that works so well and it's clear and everything like that. And I think, you know, maybe there's an argument that VAR shouldn't have been brought in until there was the ability to notice offside decisions that quickly, because it's the delay and it's the impact on the celebrations, it's the impact for the fans. And I think that's the thing that, for a lot of people, is the main issue with VAR. It's not whether it's offside or not, because, as Ollie said, you know, it is offside or not. You know, it's like the technology needs to sort of improve more so that for those decisions that aren't subjective, they are onside or offside, goal or no goal, it needs to be instant. And then, you know, whether you use it for subjective decisions is a whole other argument, because even with VAR, you could watch it again and again and again. With a handball, somebody could have an opinion, somebody else could have a different opinion. So I think that's part of the problem with VAR generally. And yeah, to be quite honest, I'm sort of a bit annoyed it's invaded the Premier League as well as the Women's World Cup.
But you're right, we shouldn't necessarily be talking about it, so we won't talk about it for very long. But I wanted to just get your take, Gregor, on VAR as well, because I don't know if you heard Jonathan Woodgate speaking after Middlesbrough's loss to Brentford at the weekend. He was fuming about decisions that went against Middlesbrough. And he's saying, well, why don't we have it in the Championship? Do you have any sympathy towards Woodgate? And do you think if you're going to have it in the Premier League, we really should be having it elsewhere as well?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, we've been hearing for the last couple of years when whilst we've known this technology exists. I mean, why are we not bringing video assistant referees into the game? And now they're here. We're finding all the little teething troubles and the flaws in it. One thing I would say about that, I mean, that was the Sterling incident, his offside. Mm. That was probably the most sort of challenging use of it that there's been, and I'm not sure how often we're going to get offsides that are that close to call. We're sort of starting to get debates on social media about the speed of freeze frames and slow motions and whether the technology even exists to call the offside, whether it's a millimetre or 2 millimetres, you know. I don't think we're going to see that all that often. And as Ollie said, the sort of the Leicester Wolves game, that's something to do with the laws rather than the laws of the game rather than VAR. Yes, it should certainly be in other divisions, but that's probably all about money. I think until all these sort of issues are ironed out, then probably they're better off without it just now.
One thing that surprised me in the days leading up to the start of the season was that it came out that the VAR were going to be reluctant, really, to intervene in cases of, you know, violent conduct, or, you know, that there was going to be a sort of, I think it was described, a sort of high tolerance threshold to sort of red card offences, all that kind of thing, which just seems a bit bizarre. I mean, it seems a bit strange to be agonising over these absolutely fine marginal offsides, and yet a pretty wild challenge can come in from Che Adams in the Burnley Southampton game, and you know, that looked to me like a red card, and that was allowed to go because they're seemingly not as keen to intervene in those cases as they are on offsides. Now, I know one is a tackle and one's a goal or not a goal, but the idea of VAR is, if it's perfectly implemented and it's been totally sensibly thought through, is probably acceptable to everybody. But I just find some of the decisions around it, the decisions around how it's going to be implemented, I find them very strange.
Where do you draw the line otherwise if you're stopping play so often? And I think that's what happened in the Women's World Cup. So I think I can understand why they're talking about having a higher threshold. And obviously even the penalty kick that was brought back, there people were slightly confused about that until we found out it was about encroachment. So I understand that actually from that point of view. I think if it's not the clear and obvious is really important. If we're not sort of gauging it by that, then the game will stop even more often, and it really will become a major problem.
I think the Premier League have sort of said that they're not going to use VAR for goalkeepers having one foot on the line for their penalties, yeah, because of how poorly that was sort of used by VAR in the Women's World Cup. So it's sort of like there are still teething problems. And what's frustrating is that, you know, this technology has been there and we've been waiting for so long for it to come in. And now it's in, we're still finding things that it doesn't quite work for. So I think it's definitely a work in progress. And hopefully, as the season goes on, we'll all get more used to it, the players, the referees and the VAR referees. And hopefully this won't be such a talking point, I guess.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Manchester City picked up just as they left off last season, a 5-0 win over a West Ham side that had people talking over the summer. I remember in our preview podcasts, it was really just Alison Rudd that went for Liverpool to win the league. From what we've seen from Manchester City in this one game, can anyone stop them, Ollie?
Well, they did only finish a point above Liverpool last season, but I find myself thinking that can anybody stop City? I know people are saying, "Oh, it's Liverpool and City, Liverpool, and then the rest." But I think City are the best team in the Premier League. But I know, you know, people say, "Oh, Liverpool won the Champions League. Liverpool only finished a point behind them." Both of those things are true. But I do feel that City, with the strength that they've got, and they've got stronger, which Liverpool probably haven't really. They've got stronger. They've got Kevin De Bruyne back after missing most of last season, or never really getting a run of games last season. And I just thought they showed on Saturday, I mean, the first 25 minutes, until they scored, really, they were slow out of the blocks, really. And you were thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe West Ham have found some way to frustrate them. But after that, it was like an exhibition game. They were so far ahead of West Ham after that. The second half, it could have finished off, you know, 7 or 8. It really could. I think City have got the ability to do that this season. I think that, you know, they've scored in vast numbers of goals over the last couple of seasons under Guardiola. But I think they can win games comfortably, really comfortably, almost every time they play. They are so good, so technically perfect, and it's so hard to, you know, inflict any kind of damage on them because it's so hard even to get the ball off them. I think they are absolutely the team to beat, and it's going to be very hard for anyone to live with them.
So comfortable that Jose Mourinho said to Manchester City and Manchester City's B team are title contenders, Molly.
I think, yeah, you sort of can't disagree when you look at that bench. I mean, it was Claudio Bravo, Gundogan, Aguero, Bernardo Silva, Cancelo, Otamendi and Foden. And literally any other team in the Premier League, probably all of those, or at least a significant percentage, would have started. And I think that's something that, you know, you look at Liverpool last season and they were very, very good. But they had players that they relied upon really heavily in that starting 11. I mean, the front three in particular, if you look at Divock Origi, they probably wasn't expecting as much from him as what he managed to deliver. And I think, you know, you're asking an awful lot for those three and Origi to play that well this season. Whereas with City, they've just got so many options. You know, if any one of those, you know, front players isn't playing so well, they've got that such strength and depth in there. They've brought in Rodri, who's looked really impressive, actually, and looked as though he's a natural sort of replacement for Fernandinho, and also, you know, provides them that little bit more of balance and is able to help them defensively as well. So I think it's too early to say, you know, that's it, Man City are going to run away with the title. But I think when you look at it on paper, as Mourinho says, it's just such a good team. And I think, you know, that's what they've done well with their recruitment. They've found they have identified their weaknesses and they've sort of acted on them and got the right people in. And I suppose, you know, we talk a lot about money in the Premier League and all of that, but if you don't make the right signings, then it doesn't really mean anything. But they seem to have done once again. And Rodri, you know, as I say, he looked like a really good fit.
Yeah. Gregor, what did you make of Rodri, who, of course, is Manchester City's club record signing?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Molly. It's just they seem to have every sort of aspect of the football club running just like a well-oiled machine. And recruitment is no different. I think Rodri was highlighted as a player that could come in and sort of fit into the team seamlessly, but also be someone who's a sort of linchpin of the team for many years to come. And all the signs are he's fitting very well. A few times, I think, sort of speed of the game in the Premier League, he's maybe got caught in possession on the edge of his own box or around his own box, and he did so in the last half an hour or so of the Community Shield as well. So I think maybe there will be a little bit of a period of catching up to the pace of the Premier League. But he certainly looks like a perfect player for that position, which is really crucial for the way Manchester City play.
For all the positives of Manchester City, the West Ham boss Manuel Pellegrini accused them of making tactical fouls in that defeat. We have sort of talked about it before on previous podcasts, Ollie, but does he have a point? He did mention that every time we try to arrive in their box, they committed fouls. We were innocent in that regard. They committed 13 fouls. We committed 5. That wasn't the reason why we lost, he said, but they didn't help matters.
I bet a former professional footballer like Gregor would say that if you're under that much pressure against a superior team and you could only concede 5 fouls in 90 minutes, that's not something a manager should be bragging about, how few fouls they concede. I mean, City do that. They, you know, Fernandinho is a master at it. Bernardo Silva is a master at it. But I find it all quite weird that this has become a great outrage in 2019 or 2018, as it probably was when it first came up, because this has been going on for 10, 15 years, and generally people get booked for it. And if they don't get booked for it, if it's a foul on somebody's trying to break on the counter attack and they're 70 yards from goal, but somebody pulls them back or trips them, generally you get a yellow card for that. Well, you should get a yellow card, and if you don't, then you've got lucky. But Rodri got booked eventually on Saturday. I think nearly all Fernandinho's yellow cards and Bernardo Silva's yellow cards and David Silva's yellow cards are of that type. So there's no denying that they do it. I think if Guardiola denies that they're doing it, that's pretty silly. But everybody does it, or nearly everybody does it. And those that don't do it, while knowing that the sanction will generally be a yellow card, it's silly not to. If you can cynically but safely foul a player in a way that stops you getting done on the counter attack, then why wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's regarded as a good foul. That's what you call it. Mm. I've done many of them myself, and and I think I would say, though, that it does seem to be a little bit more of a sort of tactic, a sort of something that is evident that Manchester City do. I don't know whether that's because they pile so many bodies forward and, you know, they're so expansive in the play, but it does seem to be that it's something are, I wouldn't say coaching, but it's certainly a tactic that you would notice a little bit more, I think, in Manchester City than other teams. But like I say, that's probably because they have so much of the ball, they play so expansively, and when they lose the ball and up the pitch and they've only got two, perhaps three bodies back, that's the safest way for them to commit a foul and then get back into their shape. So it's understandable why they do it.
And just a word on West Ham, Molly. Okay, 5-0. You don't want to start the season in that way. But as we mentioned at the start of this little segment, people have been talking up West Ham. Do we have much expectation for them?
I think it almost feels a bit deja vu, because I think you sort of probably felt a little bit of the same last season. Obviously, you've got Pellegrini there, who's a great manager, and they've sort of always felt like on paper that team could be better than the result it seems to get. I think, you know, West Ham are probably one of those teams that you look like and you think, who are the players that are really going to dig in and get a result? And they don't always have those players. You know, they have the stars and they have the players that look really good on paper, but actually when it comes down to it, when it's a difficult game, they don't always seem to be the side that just gets that point or just gets that last minute winner that really affects the game and ultimately the Premier League table at the end of the season. So I think, you know, West Ham fans must be pretty frustrated really, because they see the potential that it has and they see Pellegrini as the manager, and you know, they're probably thinking they should be doing a little bit better than they are. But obviously, as we've said throughout this pod, I mean, it's the first day of the season and, you know, thankfully they don't have to play Man City every week.
How true. Anfield hosted the season opener, and what an opener it was. Four first half goals against Norwich, all but won the game before the halftime whistle rang, and then that set them on their way to a 4-1 win in the end. We'll talk about the Premier League new boys in a little while, but Ollie, 4-1, did that flatter Jurgen Klopp's side?
Yeah, it did. I mean, the same way that you'd say it of Man United beating Chelsea 4-0. I mean, Liverpool-Norwich was not a 4-1, or it didn't feel like a 4-1. At the time, Liverpool scored their second. I mean, Norwich had probably been threatening an equaliser, the force could say, from Alisson. I think when they conceded another two goals before half-time, I mean, for it to be 4-0 at half-time just felt so harsh. You were impressed by how clinical Liverpool had been. But it was, and the intensity that they played with for in spells. But it was it was harsh, the 4-0 halftime scoreline. Norwich played some really nice stuff, and yet, you know, they made defensive mistakes. But I don't really go with this idea that it was completely naive the way they played. I think it was a terrible sort of slice by Grant Hanley for the first goal. There was Van Dijk was left unmarked for the third goal. But generally, I don't think playing out from the back is going to be Norwich's problem. They will concede goals playing that way, but it's the way they want to play. It's the way they played in order to get promotion. You know, it works for them. And as Daniel Farke said on Friday night, you know, they're not going to suddenly change to parking the bus every week because they're in the Premier League. They need to do what they to play the way that suits the players they've got, and they've got all these very talented young players, and I like the wide players in particular, the fullbacks and the wide midfielders. But it's they were against Liverpool, who were clinical. I think they were much better after half time, and I came away from that thinking, you know, Norwich have got a good chance of staying up here, which is not typical thing you would say after a newly promoted team loses 4-1 on the opening day.
Well, we mentioned that the strength and depth that Manchester City have on this pod already, and people were suggesting that Liverpool needed to strengthen. They had, as you already pointed out, Molly, quite a reliance on their starting 11, but when you look further into their squad, it perhaps didn't have that game-changing factor that a Manchester City squad would have. Does it surprise you that they didn't bring really anybody in this window?
I think it does a little bit. I think I sort of understand where Jurgen Klopp was coming from. I think he said, you know, they had such a good team, a solid team, and he was quite wary of bringing in new players that might disrupt that. And I think what Man City have probably done so well, particularly in recent seasons, I mean, when Pep first took over, he did make quite a big overhaul of the squad and he got exactly who he wanted in. But then in the past few seasons, they've sort of pinpointed one place that they needed to improve upon. They've brought in one player and then sort of seamlessly transitioned instead of making this really big overhaul that's disrupted the whole team. And I think, you know, arguably that's what Liverpool could have done, that, you know, I don't think anybody was asking for wholesale changes there. Mm. You know, just perhaps in one or two positions you were just thinking, you know, maybe you need a little bit more cover. I mean, you look at players like Van Dijk, I mean, Alisson, who obviously got injured against Norwich. Without those sort of players, you do wonder, you know, the strength and depth isn't quite there. But I think, you know, again, as I mentioned earlier, you could sit here and if you say, you know, Firmino, Salah and Mane, if they can play as well as they did last season and they can stay injury-free, you've also got players like Oxlade-Chamberlain that are back now. Obviously, he had that really long injury that kept him out. Naby Keita, he had his injury problems last season. Adam Lallana. So they do sort of have that strength and depth there. But at the same time, you are going to get injuries. And I think perhaps they were quite lucky last season that Van Dijk and Alisson didn't get injured. And, you know, as we've seen so early on, you know, that's not going to last forever. And at some point, your key players are going to get injured. And then that's where Jurgen Klopp must be thinking, oh, you know, sod's law that it's Alisson that's got injured, because he's such an important part of their team. And he was the signing that sort of took them that step further and probably won them the Champions League.
Mm. Gregor, is the strength and depth a concern for you, for Liverpool?
Well, obviously, the injury to Alisson sort of brought home the fact that Liverpool were pretty fortunate last season in keeping all their key players fit. I think he's set to be out for about 8 weeks, and that's obviously going to be a big blow for Liverpool. So I think, though, on the whole, they have a squad that's, you know, they've welcomed back a few players from injury over the summer. And they have a squad that's easily capable of handling the Premier League campaign. The only thing is around Christmas time, we're going to have extra fixtures. And I think that's the time that they really are going to be tested. But I think they have the squad to cope with the rigours of a Premier League campaign. It's just whether that squad is going to be able to keep up with Manchester City.
Ollie, what do you think about Liverpool's squad that they have right now?
I think if you looked at it last season, you would have said if there was one thing that cost them, I mean, look, again, to repeat, 97 points, which is, you know, an incredible total. But if there's one thing that stopped them getting 99 points, 100 points, whatever it would have taken to win the league, you would say during that period where, you know, January, February, where the fixtures had built up and, you know, heavy pitches and so on, people like Salah seemed to be in need of a bit of a rest, and there was a bit of shortage in certain positions, defensive positions in particular. And, you know, the squad on paper is actually weaker than last season in that they've lost Alberto Moreno and Daniel Sturridge, who, okay, look, you know, they didn't play many minutes of football last season, and you know, they're probably not really players that Klopp was able to rely on, but they have. You know, they are looking for Naby Keita and Oxlade-Chamberlain to provide the improvement, having missed most of last season due injury. And they're looking for younger players like Ryan Brewster to step up and fill a gap. And it's very hard, really, to predict that Liverpool will match what they did last season, which was win the Champions League, incredible, get 97 points in the Premier League, incredible. How do you replicate that? How do you improve on it without buying? So I thought that they would do a bit more in the transfer market, but I think we've probably learned to trust Klopp's judgment over the years, and he does know what he's doing. But I do feel that, you know, if they'd been able to strengthen even the sort of absolutely minor weaknesses in this squad, like Manchester City have been. Then they'd probably be in a stronger position.
But the loss of Alisson will be a big blow to them.
Yeah, I mean, he had such a good, strong, commanding presence on them last season. I mean, just from the moment he arrived, really, when there was a couple of little close turns that were ill-advised, but he was just such a good signing for them. I think Simon Mignolet will probably be thinking, God, why couldn't he have been injured last season when I was there? But Mignolet is a perfectly competent goalkeeper who probably
was never really going to be trusted again at Liverpool because there was baggage there in terms of him as a Liverpool goalkeeper, in the same way that there was with Karius. And I think perhaps a new goalkeeper like Adrian coming in from West Ham, and I think he'll probably get the benefit of the doubt more often, and teammates will probably trust him a bit more than they trusted Mignolet, which sounds really harsh on Mignolet because he's a perfectly competent keeper. But I think Liverpool's fans will probably feel more confident with a new reserve goalkeeper than they would either of the previous ones. But I mean, Alisson was the difference between 1 point and three on occasions last season, and I think it will be the pressure will be on Adrian to bail him out at some point over the next few weeks.
Well, let's talk about the Premier League new boys now. We've touched on Norwich, who lost 4-1 to Liverpool, but there were some good signs for Daniel Farke to take out of that match. Timu Pukki looked lively up top, and then they also had the introduction of Moritz Leitner, who made Norwich look even more dangerous on the break. But that downfall was the amount of space that Liverpool found regularly in that game at Anfield. I know Ollie's already mentioned it, but Gregor, does Daniel Farke have to change the way Norwich play, or can they actually go into these Premier League games in similar fashion as to how they did in the Championship?
Yeah, I was a little bit puzzled by the sort of reaction to Norwich's play on Friday. I mean, anyone who watched them last season knew they were going to play the same way. Daniel Farke is pretty evangelical about his sort of philosophy and the way Norwich are going to play. So that was always going to be the case. And I think the way they, the way they tried to build play from the back, that really didn't contribute to any of the goals they conceded. I think the worrying thing is Liverpool really didn't have to lay a glove on them to score those goals. I think Origi got past Max Ahrens far too easily. I know there was a bit of an aberration, the own goal for the first goal. Van Dijk completely unmarked for the second. Origi again ghosted inside Ahrens for the third. I just think that really, we've said that Man City won't have to play. West Ham won't have to play Man City every week, and the same sort of thing was said about Norwich not having to go to Anfield every week. Liverpool didn't have to do much to score those goals, and that was the worry. I said that on the preview podcast, that they conceded 57 goals last season as they won the league, which is, I think it was 16 more than Sheffield United, and who finished second. And they have to change that. They're going to win some games 4-3 perhaps, and they will score goals. I think we saw that. They look a threat going forward. Some really exciting young players, but they're going to have to remedy that, and they're often individual mistakes, and it's not easy to do.
Aston Villa, well, they almost won that first game, didn't they, in the sense they went 1-0 up against Tottenham. They led up until the break, but then they went on to lose that 3-1 in North London. 12 brand new signings for Dean Smith and Aston Villa. Molly, from what you've seen of Aston Villa, did they do enough for everyone to stop comparing them to Fulham?
I think there were definitely some promising signs for Villa, and I think, compared to Fulham, I think you would have to say that Villa are in a better position. I mean, the big signing for me that I feel was sort of really insightful is probably Tom Heaton. I mean, he's one of those goalkeepers he's just solid. And what he's done for Burnley over the years, he is, how we talk about Alisson, the difference between 1 point and 3 points. But he really has been that so many times for Burnley, and there's times where he's really sort of literally had a barrage of shots on his goal, and he's just stood tall, and he's been that player that's been so important for them. And I think for Villa, you've got players like Grealish and McGinn that, they do have the quality going forward. But someone like Heaton, he's that calm presence. He's got the experience, and again, Tottenham are a very, very good team, and the fact that they were able to score, yes, they conceded goals, but they won't, they won't always have to defend, and Heaton won't always have to face shots from the players of like Harry Kane's caliber. So I think, they should be in a better position than Fulham to defend. I mean, for long spells of that game, they did defend quite well, and I think, against the sort of middle of the table teams, and particularly the ones that they've come up with, they'll sort of back themselves to be better than them, and I think they probably will be. And I think it certainly won't be a situation like Fulham where the defending was just calamitous at times. I think, you know, there's signs there for Villa that they have got a little bit more stability and, you know, they're more prepared for the top flight.
Ollie, was it fair that we compared Aston Villa's transfer activity to what Fulham did last season?
No, I think it's inevitable when people see a newly promoted team, a club, spending loads of money and sort of outspending almost all of the heavyweights in the Premier League. I think it's a natural sort of comparison to make when there's a bad example in recent, you know, very, very recent memory. But one thing people forget about the Fulham spending is that an awful lot of it, or in terms of the number of players that came in, an awful lot of that was done in the final days, never mind weeks, of the transfer window. Whereas Villa, it all seemed a lot more organised, thought out. A lot of, you know, nearly all of it was done by the end of July, I think. It looked much better thought out. You know, adding Tyrone Mings, who obviously was fantastic for them last season on loan. I think that was a big, big, important signing. And I know people would say, God, 26 million or whatever it was, but I thought he was really good on Saturday. I think they will be the best of the three newly promoted teams. I don't have any real sense that they'll struggle at all, which I know sounds ridiculous, but I look at their team and I see a lot of quality, a lot of character, personality, playing for their manager. He's got them organised. They've got momentum from those amazing last couple of months in the Championship, and I think they'll be fine.
Well, of the three teams that came up, it was only Sheffield United that didn't lose. They left it late, though, and it was fans' favourite Billy Sharp who picked up where he left off last season to grab an 88th-minute equaliser at Bournemouth, with that game finishing 1-1. Gregor, how important is it that Billy Sharp got that first goal? He got the monkey off his back, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this was the story of the weekend, really. We've talked a lot about VAR and the big boys, but this is a real fairy tale story. Billy Sharp, someone who actually I played against throughout my career, and going way back to when he kicked it all off at Scunthorpe in League One and Doncaster, and you know, there was even question marks about whether he could score goals in the Championship, and he's done that in the last couple of seasons in particular. And yeah, it was brilliant. It was great scenes to see the celebrations afterwards as well. And I think Chris Wilder deserves a lot of credit as well, because he threw on three subs: Freeman, McBurney, and Sharp. And he always does that. He's very brave with his substitutes, and he said, right, we're going to get something from this game. And I think he was right when he said afterwards that they deserved to. And I think Eddie Howe really agreed too. I think Sheffield United are going to get a lot of plaudits this season. Whether they stay up or not, it's going to be tight, because the sort of resources they have compared to all the other clubs are sort of really, really small. But they have a group of players that have been together for so many years, and Billy Sharp as their talisman to come off the bench and score some crucial goals. So I hope we see more of that this season.
Yeah, as you said, it was a fairy tale moment for Billy Sharp, that is for sure. OK, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Molly Hudson and Oliver Kay. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And Gregor and I will be back on Thursday following Chelsea and Liverpool's clash in the Super Cup, with all the best analysis and build-up to the weekend's action as well.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.